Vernon Benjamin's The History of the Hudson River Valley from Wilderness to the Civil War presented nearly 250 years of the Hudson River Valley's dynamic past with unmatched richness. Now, with his new book, The History of the Hudson River Valley from the Civil War to Modern Times, Benjamin, a longtime resident and recognized chronicler of the Hudson Valley, brings readers through the fascinating and formative years from the Civil War onward into the post-September 11th moment, completing his account of one of America's most significant regions. It's a great pleasure to welcome Vernon Benjamin back to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure always to see you.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here again.
I know we spoke to you when the last book came out, and so I knew this book was coming, but it actually happened faster than I thought. And these are both very, very big books. Were you well on your way on the second one when the first one was done?
Yes, actually, I wrote the whole book at once. And the publisher and I had a big argument, and I lost, so we had two volumes instead of one. And I'm very happy because I was able to spend those intervening 2 years tinkering with this volume, which needed it. And I think it's a much better product because of that time.
And it would have been a really, really big book.
I know. That was the argument he won at.
So this idea from the Civil War to modern times, is it a fairly natural point for the story and the first book to break off and for this book to start up?
Absolutely. I mean, not just the fact that page-wise it's almost perfectly in half, but I think that the one of the most defining moment in American history was the death of Lincoln. And my first book ends with his funeral parade up through the valley. I think after that, everything changed. The whole small-time colonial, small business entrepreneurial type of valley became enmeshed in the whole American experience of corporate America and the growth and population and industrial growth that was caused by the upgrading of the Civil War. Just catapulted us into the 20th century. It is a different history.
When you look at this more modern history, at what point do you start to get an idea of what not only the valley would become and but the modernization of the region?
It's an interesting question. There may be more than one point, but initially I think it was the second industrial wave that came through and the building of the railroads in particular and how they transformed the valley and American society in the same way the steamboats had and the sloops before them in very dramatic ways. And they continued on until the rise of the automobile in the 1920s. And that, of course, also dramatically transformed the nature of the history.
In that transformation of the history, and I know we talked about it the last time you were here, but how much of that is guided by the river itself and the topography?
A great deal of it. First of all, just physically, the topography, the river is really the spine of the body that is the valley. And the tributaries are like the ribs that carry the water, but also the commerce of the valley into the metropolitan area. And in a different way, also the river is represents the lifeblood of the valley. And the transformation that took place was a very interesting one, from the use of the river for commercial purposes and for beauty, but really to create industries all along it, to the gradual disappearance of those industries and the empty highway, so to speak, that we have today, although it is busier now than it was 20 or 30 years ago, the river.
Many of the stories that you told in the first book, that for those of us that live in the region, there's a mythology. There are these wonderful stories that we hear about that are so connected to the river and its history. And this book chronicles sort of our reaction and our realization of those stories and how they impact us now.
I think to some extent, an abiding character throughout the whole history is Rip Van Winkle. a creation of Washington Irving.
Right.
You see his manifestation in many ways. Edith Wharton talks about a village that has fallen asleep and been lost in the passage of time. In modern times, modern Rip Van Winkle themes emerge in how America, or how the Valley actually adapts to America's progress. Sometimes it embraces it wholly, and sometimes it snoozes through it. Rip Van Winkle is a key character in my whole book. I think there are others too. I think the whole romantic feel that Irving and Cooper and the artists of the 19th century created is a characteristic defining aspect of the Hudson River Valley. Aesthetics is something that is key to this valley more than any other region that I know of.
There's this one character that you mention in the book, and I want to get to it. We'll talk about it here more toward the beginning of the interview than at the end. This guy by the name of Alan Shartok, who you write about
in
the book, of starting this radio station and talking about his spirit and bringing the station alive to the Hudson River Valley. And I have to say, as I was reading the book, I was surprised to see that crop up. But it's very, very cool because it does show the incubator that this region has been, so that people like Alan and others could start these very important projects.
Well, that's a great way to put it, and that's true. Of course, that's in the section about the rise of radio, first AM and then FM, and
yes,
of course then the rise of National Public Radio. And Alan very much belongs here, so do you, Joe, I'm afraid to say. You're a part of history. In fact, that section, I entitled it with the 800 number that rings across the valley a couple of times a year in those wonderful campaigns that you carry on.
When you think about the region, and because of the river, and I mentioned the topography, but also geography of, and again, I think we mentioned this too, New York City has a lot to do with this story, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, throughout the history. It's a part of the history for a great deal of it. I agonized over when I could possibly leave New York City. At first, I thought I could leave with George Washington in 1783, and then I find myself writing about Edgar Allan Poe in 1847 and 6 miles from the city in Kips Bay. And even today, the city is very much a part of us, in the water resources in particular, and in our shared interests in the Hudson River's estuary's health. And of course, in what's going on in terms of the commercial activities and connecting Albany and Buffalo in the West with New York City, that still remains a very important part of our economy.
Vernon Benjamin is our guest. The name of the new book is The History of the Hudson River Valley, From the Civil War to Modern Times. Let us take a step back before we go too much further, and that is, what brought you to this project from the very beginning?
I got a call out of the blue. I didn't realize it, but the CEO of Viking Penguin of New York and London was calling Vern Benjamin to see if I'd be interested in writing the history of the Hudson Valley. When I got up off the floor, I said, yeah, I would be. And he asked me to write an outline, and I left my house. I rented a house many miles away and holed up there and wrote it in a month. And a couple of months later, I got the word that he wanted to do it.
How did you become interested in the history of this area? You have lectured at both Bard and Marist on the history of this region. What interested you about it?
Well, my interest of it came through my journalism career, and in particular, a wonderful old editor named Don Fellows, who ran the Old Dutch Post Star, a small weekly in Saugerties. He brought me on to write stories on town, school, and village board meetings, and paid me $5 a story and wanted to help me out, so he tried to get me to write history columns, and finally did, and he got $5 for those too. And Peter Mayer saw a couple of those, and was also, my name was recommended to him by a mutual friend.
When you take on a project like this, the two volumes, and we're talking about the second and final, so this is something that there are so many facets to this. Radio you mentioned, and there's the environmental story, there's the historical story, the revolutionary story, as you recalled. And does it become unwieldy at some point? How were you able to rein it in?
Hmm. That's interesting, because the anecdotes and the small stories and the detail of the book do tend toward unwieldiness. And I recalled, I've been reading in preparation for this, and I recalled some of my agonies in going through some of these sections. The movement, for example, from Storm King Mountain through the rise of the great legislation on the state and national level that case brought about, included a cleanup of the Hudson River and of many other sites. And getting into the details of those cleanups, you find yourself lost in wanting to tell the story accurately, and then you have to come out of it really in the same section. And I was able to do that by tying in environmentalism with the cultural heritage that was also growing at the same time. That was that particular problem, not being overcome by the detail, was one that haunted me and intrigued me also throughout the whole book.
The Thruway plays a big role in the story too, doesn't it?
Yes. The Thruway's construction was a culmination of a process, an evolution of transportation policy and thinking that began in the late 19th century, when roads weren't much to speak of and were handled by local communities, by men in local neighborhoods who rounded up a few neighbors and worked on pieces of the road. And that overseer model evolved into a state-supported model involving the counties and the towns from about 1905 on. One of the first bond acts for New York that was successful was a transportation bond act, I think in 1905 or 1907. And once the automobile came, of course, that increased the pace. But it was really the bicycle that brought on the good roads movement and made good roads necessary and drew the state into it. By the time you get to the Thruway, the transformation is such that the entire process has been given over to engineers, including the environmental reviews. They didn't use those terms back in that day in the 40s and 50s. But basically the argument was that the engineers say we should do it this way, so that's the way we're going to do it. And that's what judges told the city of Yonkers, for example, when the Thruway came through and wiped out the whole center of their business district. The engineers say it's necessary, so it is.
What is the relationship between the Thruway and the path, the natural path of the river?
The Thruway basically does what the railroad did. It mimics the river by running a straight line up the river. But in doing so, it also alienates the communities along the river. And we've adjusted to it. We work with it now. But I kept referring to Lewis Mumford and the Regional Planning Association, Benton McKay, who were interested in a limited access highway that would enter towns and villages in more discreet ways and not severely damage or alter the landscape along the way. The Thruway just set that all aside.
I was fascinated in reading that part of the book because it seems to me I think of when I want to go and visit various towns in the Hudson Valley that the Thruway is very convenient because I can hop on in Albany and I can get off and visit one of these spots along the Hudson River. Whereas, yes, that very real problem of, okay, but you can also take the Thruway from Albany to New York City and not even realize that there are towns on the right and left of it.
Absolutely. And imagine all of the farms and all the farm animals that were along the old way when you meandered your way on through, like Thomas Dewey did when he came up from Pauline every Monday morning and wended his way through the river towns and usually with some important person along with him to introduce to his political friends in the towns and villages that he passed through. We've lost that sense of place, but in a sense, we're more American. I mean, the need for the Thruway was demonstrated on 9/11 when the airports were closed down and Iron Mountain came in and started trucking things in from all over the country to restore the businesses that were destroyed.
I realize I'm about to ask you a very general question to which the answer is probably it depends. But when you think about the river and this valley, how good has it been at planning for growth, planning for development, planning for the future?
That's a loaded question. I think that in some ways it's been great, but it takes too long. The Bronx River Parkway, for example, was conceived around 1910 or 1912. Wasn't built until the 1920s, and it was the first of the beautiful limited access highways in America, and it still has some very attractive aspects to it. Had that thinking proceeded, we might have more highways like that. The Conic Parkway is a little bit like that too, but in other ways too, the progress of the valley has been one of catching up with the pace of events and the pace of population growth that require changes in the valley's history and in how the valley lives and survives. I think that we've been in a catch-up mode all the while. That's true of the Tappan Zee Bridge today.
And that is a good example of what we've been going through on projects such as that for a long, long time.
It certainly is. To me, it's exactly like the tanning industry. Here you want to just look at the marvel of the structure rising. It's an amazing structure. And credit the American ingenuity with the ability to do these unbelievable things. Bringing animal hides up from South America, trucking, carrying them really all the way up into the mountains, tanning them and carrying them back down to the markets of the world. You have to acknowledge that American industry is as large as the continent that we live in. At the same time, the destruction of the hemlock forests and what the Thruway has done and how the Tappan Zee Bridge, I'm not familiar with the whole story, but I think that the environmental impacts of the Tappan Zee Bridge, particularly in the death of sturgeon that has taken place there, have been passed over or glossed over by the planners. And I think that's partly because we're hurrying up to catch up.
Mm. You write about Troy in the book and, of course, the collar city, where collars were made for our shirts. And when that industry goes, then it does. There's another good example of what many towns dealt with up and down the river of when that industry goes, then what?
Well, that is true. The collar industry's demise, which really was a result of the whole growth of the mercantile world that took place in the period after 1890, impacted Troy severely. Troy was able to rebound partly because of the Deepwater Port issue that came up in Albany in the 1920s and brought a lot of industry to Troy. And, of course, mm-hmm. Troy as being an outlet of the Erie Canal. And I think the Harmony Mills also helped to absorb some of the workforce that Troy lost.
We would be neglectful if we didn't mention the Erie Canal and its importance to this story.
Yes, and I think it still is, first in a cultural sense. You know, tourists come up the river and then go up the Erie Canal.
Yeah,
they might go down around St. Lawrence and come back again. You know, it's and that is still a vital aspect of the Northeast. And, of course, the Mohawk Valley is important to our commerce as well.
And your mind is the Hudson River Valley from say Troy to New York City, or does it go well into the Adirondacks?
Today, I would put it just past Glens Falls,
mm-hmm.
to where the big boom was located, about 3 or 4 miles upriver from Glens Falls. If you leave Glens Falls, you notice that you go over a little hill when you go into Lake George.
Yes,
and that's you're entering a whole new wonderland, a whole new region there, and that's the end of the Hudson Valley. Coming south right now, I would put the end at the Yonkers and New York City border, although the Bronx certainly was a part of it. That's where Satan's Stowe was in Cooper's fiction, where the story of the Spoitin' Doyle, Washington Irving story unfolds, and Manhattan and the Verrazano Narrows. And if you go into prehistory and the geological period, 120 miles out to the continental shelf was all a part of the Hudson River Valley.
For you and me, we live along the river, and we pass it, and we see it, and we're in the valley every single solitary day. For the people who live in Chicago and Illinois and Texas and other parts of this country, it's through that fiction that they learn about the Hudson River.
That's exactly right. Yes, and the Hudson River has also benefited from some great photographers and from other great writers.
Not to mention Frederick Church and the arts and the whole.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's an amazing river. I think I tend to agree that it depersonalizes you, that it isn't as intimate and as close as the tributary streams, where you can walk along and just enjoy the beauty of the valley in momentary epiphanies. The river, you look at it as a piece of sublimity, of awe, and that certainly is a characteristic, as it was throughout its history.
Are there ever times, now that you have written 1,200 pages on this river valley, that you're driving down the thruway on your way to Saugerties and you think to yourself, oh, damn, I should have written about dot, dot, dot?
Yes. You know, first of all, the grossest error in this book is I left the King of England out.
How'd you leave the King of England out?
I remember writing it, but it didn't make the final cut. And it was a wonderful little moment where Eleanor Roosevelt drives the King and Queen back to the rail station at Hyde Park, where they get on their train to go north to Montreal, a train going north instead of south. And there was a little rock wall there that the train went around and some mist in the air. And Eleanor's comment evokes that kind of romantic spirit of how beautiful this setting was, and also how full of not fear, but concern and a worldwide caring about the outcome of England and what happens with the war. It was a beautiful moment in history that I left out.
Was that the hot dog picnic?
Yes, that's the other part.
And that just goes to show of how many wonderful stories there are. And again, back to that idea of trying to wrangle it all together.
I know. Well, yes, that's the beauty of it, too.
I was struck. There was a very nice piece in The New York Times recently about this book. And Sam Roberts, who wrote the piece, said this is an uninterrupted story, meaning the first and second volume, without a finale. And that's it, right? Mm-hmm. You could write a third volume, but it probably should best be written many, many years from now.
By somebody's great-grandchild, I think.
Yes.
History doesn't end. There is no ending. You know, there are moments where you can stop and pause, and I do at the burning of the Catskill Mountain House, but that's 1963. But really, that was a critical moment. That was kind of the end of Romanticism and the birth of a new type of environmentalism and cultural heritage era that we are in now. We could keep going on about that, and I did, to talk about how the new, more militant environmentalism was born here in the Hudson Valley and has occupied people's interests, especially ordinary people, for the past 50 years. We are not in some concluding moment of the valley's history. 9/11 changed things, and I touched upon 9/11, but I knew that it was a different history after that moment. It is what do they call the new age now, the Anthropocene?
Yes.
The period from 1950 on, when man becomes the critical feature of the world environment. And in a sense, our critical environment has changed because of 9/11.
The name of the new book is The History of the Hudson River Valley from the Civil War to Modern Times. It is not only a great book, but it's a beautiful book. It's beautifully put together. From the end papers to the maps and pictures in it, it's a gorgeous volume. Vernon Benjamin, thank you very much for being with us and for sharing with us this morning and for taking on such a great project.
Well, thank you.
Great
Enjoy
pleasure.
Being here.
Thank you. Again, the name of the book is The History of the Hudson River Valley from the Civil War to Modern Times. The book is published by Overlook. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.